Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show...
Well, I went to the doctor. I said I'm feeling kind of rough.
We're recording this episode on Sunday, May 16th, the eve of the Shavuot festival. In Gaza and Israel, however, there's anything but a festive atmosphere, following days of heavy fighting, which have left at least 150 people dead in Gaza, as well as 10 Israelis. At the same time, there have been disturbances between Jews and Arabs in Israel's mixed cities, and the state of emergency in Lod has been extended. In a little while, we'll be hearing from Mohamed Shehadeh, a writer and civil society activist from the Gaza Strip, who's currently studying at Lund University in Sweden. But first, I'm joined by Haaretz's senior military analyst, Amos Harel. Amos, thanks for joining us. I understand you're on your way back from a military briefing on the Gaza border. Anything interesting to report, first of all?
Nothing too new, but we're still in the middle of this. It's hard to say when the actual violence would end. A lot has to do with the events of the upcoming hours. How successful Israel will be with the next strikes against Hamas on the one hand, and whether the attempts of the Egyptian negotiators would succeed in reaching some kind of a compromise which would lead us to a ceasefire.
Who's pushing for what, Amos? You reported that the IDF wants to carry out more strikes on Gaza before even starting to negotiate a ceasefire. What does it hope to achieve? What more does it hope to achieve?
Speaking to the generals here and in Tel Aviv, their perception is that there is still some space for more military achievement, that they can still strike at Hamas and cause damage, and it could be helpful in the long run. Of course, the other side of this equation is whether, at one point or another, Israel makes a mistake, which would later seem as if to make the whole thing futile or unnecessary. And of course, covering these wars or mini wars for many, many years, we've seen this has happened in the past. If you look back, at, for instance, at Operation Grapes of Wrath in Lebanon in 96, Israel seems to have had the upper hand until the time it launched a mistaken strike towards a UN camp and by mistake killed close to 100 Lebanese refugees. That was the end of the matter, and the operation ended immediately after that. And once you strike at heavily populated areas and where you try to launch rockets at terrorists or guerrilla fighters who are fighting from within the civilian population, sometimes hiding behind it or underneath it, there's always the possibility of something going wrong in a very massive way, and that could change the whole big picture. Another thing that could go terribly wrong, of course, is that Hamas would finally get it what it's trying to achieve, some kind of massive attack, whether on the border or in central Israel, which would end in serious Israeli casualties. So, thankfully, this hasn't happened yet, but the longer the operation takes, there's a bigger chance that this would actually happen.
What military achievements has the IDF recorded so far? There was a lot of talk about operation against Hamas's tunnels, for example. Was that supposed to be a game changer for the IDF?
It was supposed to be a game changer. I think there was a lot of exaggeration among some in the Israeli media about the actual outcome of this strike. It was relatively successful. It pulled Hamas out of its so-called comfort zone because its leaders no longer believe that they are safe on the ground, and this is important. On the other hand, if you investigate what the original plans were, it was quite evident that they were hoping to catch and kill hundreds of Hamas fighters, terrorists, on the ground. And evidently this didn't happen. Best case scenario from the IDF perspective is that a couple of dozen of fighters were killed there. And I'm not even sure if this has happened. So they were looking for the image that would win the war, something that would allude to an Israeli victory. I'm not sure that they've achieved that. But I have to say, on the other hand, that they've been very, very effective at hitting targets in Gaza, not only hitting bunkers and the Hamas compounds and so on, but actually hitting Hamas units, which were busy launching missiles, rockets, or anti-tank missiles at Israeli targets. And there are dozens and dozens of Hamas casualties there, and I think the operation is going on rather well. Of course, there's quite a difference, quite a gap between causing all that damage to the other side and actually pronouncing victory. I don't think that victory is a term that we could use here. Hopefully we'll have the upper hand when it ends, and this will, again, hopefully mean that for a long time Hamas would not try something like this again. But other than that, there's no flag in Iwo Jima at the end of this scenario. It's not going to happen.
Amos, you mentioned the missiles that have been raining down on Israel, over 1,000 in just a few days. What's happening with the Iron Dome? Is it working, this much-vaunted missile protection system?
As far as we can tell, the Iron Dome is actually working quite well, but considering the barrage of rockets, there would always be somewhere around 10%, which would actually escape the Israeli missiles and land in populated areas. And the end result of that, as we know, is that so far 10 Israelis have been killed in this round of violence.
Mm.
Again, without Iron Dome, I think we would have been speaking of probably close to 100 casualties on our side by now. This is not the case because Iron Dome is so successful, but it doesn't give you full security. And of course, one of the problems is that millions of Israelis, for the first time, are getting to feel on their own what it means to be under a barrage of rockets. People living in the south, where I am now, they've never gotten used to that, but this is very almost everyday reality for 20-odd years. This is not the case with people living in Tel Aviv. And I think here, when we talk of this war of images and psychological warfare that both sides are running against each other, this is probably one of Hamas's greatest achievements. The fact that people in Tel Aviv are now worried and going, having to run to the bomb shelters at night and so on, this is quite a positive outcome from Hamas's point of view. My fear is that because Hamas feels that it has been so successful at surprising the Israelis with this, they may believe that it's worth it for them to continue the violence. Other than that, I would have thought this would have been over, but it's not the case right now. And part of the reason is that Hamas is feeling so good about itself and about its own successes while striking Israeli targets.
Mm.
Their problem, of course, is that they're losing many, many fighters on the other end. But I'm not sure that their perspective is similar to our perspective regarding casualties. I think that the Palestinians in Gaza are more willing to sacrifice their men in order to achieve what they're wishing.
Mm. Amos, over the weekend, all the headlines in Israel and internationally were about the attack on a tower block in Gaza housing international media outlets. Israel claims that the building, which was home to the Associated Press and Al Jazeera and other outlets in Gaza, was also being used by Hamas's military intelligence. So, given the international outrage, has the IDF offered any evidence to back up this claim?
Not yet and not really. They were claiming that this tall building, which was hit by an Israeli airstrike, actually hosted Hamas offices.
Mm.
But we haven't seen proof of that yet. I would assume that this is true, but this is not the matter at hand. I think that, in my view, this is quite a mistake for Israel to deal with that, considering the international implications, considering the fact that you have the international media at arms over this, claiming that Israel risks lives of journalists while doing that. And we have to remember that this has come on top of the latest scandal where members of the media, of the international media in Israel, suspect that the IDF intentionally misled them about a possible ground incursion in Gaza in order to do a sort of a psy-op on the other side for the attack on Hamas's tunnel.
Mm. The IDF has denied deliberately misleading the international media, right?
Yes, they're saying that this was a mistake of a certain officer. Of course, it's a possibility, but I've talked to colleagues from the international media. They seem to be very, very angry about this, and some of them do not believe that IDF's explanations are true. So there's a lot of bad blood currently between Israel and the media, and this could be damaging for Israel's case, especially considering the fact that the Security Council is about to convene in New York. There are different matters here that could play against Israel.
Amos, I know you're extremely busy. I'm going to let you get on. Thank you, as always, for your time, and please stay safe down there.
Thank you, Simon.
Listener, after this jingle, we'll be hearing from Mohammed Chadeh, so don't go anywhere.
Mohammed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you as well. Pleasure to be here today.
So, Mohammed, in your op-ed for Haaretz over the weekend, you argue that Hamas has already won this round of fighting. What has the de facto ruler of the Gaza Strip achieved?
Well, they achieved multiple victories, either on a symbolic level or a political level. On the political level, I think the extreme and unconstrained level of Israeli brutalities and provocations, whether by the government or the far-right settler gangs in the West Bank or in Gaza, are now turning the Palestinian peace camp and, let's say, the unrequitedly collaborationist Palestinian Authority into a cautionary tale and a laughing stock of what's going to happen to you if you try moderation. And they are, in the meantime, turning the protagonists of armed resistance into heroes, the defenders of Al-Aqsa, the defenders of Gaza, and the defenders of the Palestinian struggle at large.
Are there any opposition voices being heard at the moment?
Well, before the escalation started, there was a fierce opposition to the idea of escalation, of course, relying on the logic that it would distract from the very important and legendary scenes of nonviolence in East Jerusalem. But the more this escalation goes on, the weaker these voices become, the more intimidated they would feel to voice any opposition to Hamas's actions when Israel is inflicting disproportionate damage on mainly densely populated areas in Gaza. So I can see people that are traditionally polling within the Fatah bloc or the anti-Hamas bloc, some friends who've been vehemently opponents of Hamas for decades, that now they are either silent altogether or they are praising the actions of the armed resistance factions in Gaza, because they see this as one of two things: either a force of deterrence to stop Israel from escalating further to end what's happening in Gaza and East Jerusalem and the West Bank or inside Israel, or they see it as counter-intimidation. The worse our life becomes if we continue to live in a living hell, then so should Israelis as well. And that's an interest cycle.
Hamas's popularity is sky high at the moment. What happens if this conflict drags on and on? Is there a point at which even the people of Gaza might turn around and say, it's just not worth it?
Well, there are many people that up until now are saying that this whole escalation is not worth it and that the civilian population is paying the heaviest price. But at the same time, there is, let's say, undeniable, I wouldn't say satisfaction, but fulfillment of rage and fear and terror and counter-intimidation, as I said, in the scenes of Hamas being the last line, as it's perceived, standing between Gaza's population and complete surrender and defeat. And that's the equation at the moment, is that the more this goes on, the more that Hamas is being seen as a shield or an armor that's protecting Gaza from becoming a clone of the West Bank, in which Israeli troops go in and out freely with no trouble whatsoever. And that's, again, a very clear textbook recipe for disaster. There is no way of winning this escalation, to say it in short.
So what is Hamas's endgame?
I think they got what they wanted already. And that has been clear a day after the escalation erupted on Tuesday, when Ismail Haniyeh gave a victorious speech saying that we have proven our ability to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, and that he even took credit, largely falsely, for the nonviolent protests sweeping East Jerusalem and inside Israel itself. And he said that we've been moving on three fronts, in reference to Jerusalem, inside Israel, and Gaza. So they got that sort of symbolic victory that Israel cannot take away no matter what. The question now is, how much does the Netanyahu government want to weaken the Palestinian peace camp? The further they go, the more silent any critics of this escalation will become.
Is Israel playing into Hamas's hands at the moment?
I think the Netanyahu government, they have their own interests and calculations. So the one topping any sort of educated guesses or speculative analysis is that Netanyahu wants to stay in power at any cost, and that this footage of destroying high-rise buildings in Gaza makes a perfect footage for any future elections in Israel, any campaign advertisement. You saw that with Benny Gantz, with bragging about turning large neighborhoods in Gaza back to the Stone Age. But at the same time, yes, indeed, it's playing into the hands of Hamas. The more this goes on, the more popular and relevant Hamas's platform would become.
There is an opportunism being displayed by both sides, right? The Israeli side for its reasons, and Hamas for its own reasons. The Jewish-Arab violence inside Israel is perhaps feeding Hamas's response, and vice versa. Is there a symbiotic relationship between the internecine violence within Israel and the fighting between Israel and Hamas and the other factions?
Yes, there is symbiosis here. There is a picture that's proliferating of proving that Hamas's rhetoric has been right all along, that everything they're saying about Israel only understanding the language of strength or violence is proving to be efficient. At the same time, I think that we should take a look at the events that led to this symbiosis or to this current moment. And for the last 4 months of 2021, Israel has had calm and tranquility from the Palestinian side, from Hamas's side, and in the West Bank, that it had almost never seen before over the last three decades. There were zero rocket attacks from Gaza, almost no lone wolf attacks in the West Bank. And the way that Netanyahu and his new partners, the Kahanists, wanted to reward this was to push the limits of Palestinians more, to provoke and hammer and squeeze Palestinians further and further into the corner. And this sort of bizarre and extreme provocation and brutalities have lent credence to the idea that Hamas should act and retaliate, even amongst Hamas's traditional opponents. So as I started this op-ed with, I said that a close friend of mine who's always been against Hamas, who loathes the de facto rulers of Gaza more than anybody I know, was telling me before the escalation started that if Hamas doesn't act, they would be collaborators. That if they don't stand up to Israel right now, when Jerusalem is being set ablaze, when troops are invading Al-Aqsa Mosque, or Sheikh Jarrah is being evacuated, then what good is their armed resistance? I think the events should be taken in their totality if we are to prevent this escalation from happening again within the next few months or year. There is here a cycle, a forming pattern that is too easy for Palestinians to anticipate and predict with precision. It's signified with a period of calm and quiet that Israel or Netanyahu's government uses to keep Palestinian lives the same as unlivable in Gaza, for example, or make it even worse. And as soon as an escalation starts, that's where when the narrative starts in for political decision makers outside or for the mainstream media, that's where they pick up focus on this entire area. And that's where most efforts are concentrated on restoring the pre-escalation status quo, while neglecting very dangerously and recklessly that this status quo, the inherently destabilizing status quo, is what led to this escalation in the first place.
Mohammed, before I let you go, one final question. There has been talk in Israel that now is exactly the right time for a unity government, a Jewish and Arab government to take over. From what you're hearing, from your understanding, is there any chance at the moment that the Islamist parties would join a coalition at this emergency moment?
I think it's still a possibility if the platform of the next government is going to be one of reconciliation and healing, where they would not put any issues of settlement expansion or annexation or all the topics vis-a-vis the occupied territories on the table. There's still a solid chance for that. But at the same time, the longer this escalation continues, the more difficult it would be for Israeli Arab members of Knesset to join any sort of government whatsoever. Because at the end of the day, they still have sympathies to their fellow Palestinians. And the unimaginable scenes of destruction in Gaza, as they continue joining a government that is overseeing these attacks, would be akin to being complicit and part in this assault. So I think de-escalation is paramount in order to get to this point.
Indeed. Mohammed Shehadeh, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you as well. And stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
Listener, that's our show for today. My thanks to Amos Harel, Mohammed Shehadeh, and as always, our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again soon with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, Chag Sameach from Tel Aviv.